Welcome back to the Projection Booth. This is our third of four-part series we're calling Flooding with Love for First Blood, Son, an examination of First Blood and Rambo. Let's jump right back into it, where we're talking about a rather unusual and low-budget version of David Morrell's First Blood. It was great talking to Ted Kotcheff.
Yeah. So looking at Kotcheff and Stallone's stories, the thing that was really interesting, obviously, as we said, we tried to get a hold of Sylvester Stallone and we heard back from his folks, but he was unavailable because he was out of the country to talk. But the audio commentary on the DVD and the Blu-ray, it's kind of interesting at points, Mike, because Stallone talks about the film and he talks about various things, but he never mentions Ted by his name. He always says the director.
And now I'm at the edge. I said, you got to be kidding me. I turned to the director. I said, this is not good, because the moss at the very edge, we could slide right off the edge. So right there, they decided to tie a rope to my ankle. So if I fell over, it would, you know, basically you could retrieve the body. You know, I mean, it's not going to save you, because you're going to go over and it's kind of like the bell clapper effect. Down, smash on the side of the hill, and that was it. And I knew I was in trouble when I looked around, and the entire crew and the director, they were tied to trees. And I'm the only one hanging out on the moss. I remember the director saying, could you climb up this ladder, but let's make it really strenuous. Don't use your legs. So this is me climbing the ladder, sans legs.
Yeah, it is really strange. I mean, he almost goes out of his way to not say Kotcheff's name. And it is just like, what is going on here? You know, is there bad blood about First Blood or what was going on? It was just, I mean, because Kotcheff shows up in the DVD extras. He's in some of the documentaries about the making of First Blood. But yeah, he's not to be heard and not to be mentioned on that commentary, especially the Stallone one. I think, because Morrell does a commentary as well, I think he mentions Ted once, maybe. But yeah, they remain mute on who actually did the directing so much of the time, which is just, the absence makes it very noticeable.
Yeah, and one thing that's interesting is we talked to Ted about, you know, because there are always, it doesn't matter what movie is out there, you know, because the internet is full of rumors or you've heard stories. And plus, this is 30 years on. I mean, this movie was made in 1982. Is when it came out. So there's all these stories. And of course, you know, people's memories get a little bit different or things get shaded in certain ways. And the one story that we had to ask Ted about is, as you heard in the interview, was this buyback story. Because Stallone talks about it on the audio commentary. When it was over, he didn't like the film at one point. He wanted to buy it and like hold on to the negative and not release it.
Funny story about this. This film was kind of a, it was taking disastrous turns in the editing room. And it was not working, and people were very afraid of it. And the producers had put their life savings, and they just saw their money going down the drain and being ruined. So they asked me, they put together a 40-minute screening. And I hated the film first time I saw it. I really did. Everyone did. It was just, it went on for 3.5 hours. It was just not working. The something about it, it needed to be cut and whatever. And it's not just me. I mean, everyone was feeling this is a disaster. So they, and I sort of moved on to other things. I said, oh boy, we even tried to buy the negative back and just get rid of it.
And I thought it was pretty amazing. So I don't know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it is weird. I mean, we've had that on this show before where you get two diametrically opposed versions of the same story. So it's always fascinating to me though, you know, it's just, to see how people's memories shade things. Do they really remember it this way, or are they kind of remembering a preferred version of it? But yeah, that is really strange, just the complete difference between what Kotcheff told to us and then what Stallone says about the buyback of the film.
You know, the one thing though that isn't complete bullshit, and I want no one to underestimate the value of this film. If you look at First Blood, 1982, that set the trend for for modern action films going forward, as far as I can tell. When this movie comes out, it's like sort of you can march it forward and see, okay, well, that's where all of these things come from. So what do you think it is about this film, Mike, that really sort of informed that idea maybe for the next 20 years? And I would say even today.
I think this film, and I know it's strange to say because it's a sequel, but this film and Rambo really go hand in hand, Rambo being the very oddly named sequel, you know, because people forget that this movie is called First Blood, and then the sequel is called Rambo First Blood Part 2. It's just, I don't know of any other sequels off the top of my head where they really kind of shifted the titling that much to take the main character and put his name in the title and then make it the rest. I mean, even the Dirty Harry films didn't say, you know, Dirty Harry is, you know, Magnum Force or something like that.
or even the James Bond films. I mean, it's always right. The title. It's not James Bond, you know?
James Bond says, live and let die. Yeah. But those two films together for me really set what was happening. I mean, this one definitely gave us that whole story of the guy who needs to kind of set things right. Again, I'm thinking that this one really speaks to that kind of a Western thing, the stranger coming into town and fixing things that need to be fixed. And in this one, it's not just the sheriff who needs to be fixed. And really, you know, Teasel is not this corrupt figure. He is not a bad guy. He just doesn't handle this situation correctly. So this one really kind of changed how action films would be as we went forward. And the thing that I like about this film too is that there are no catchphrases in this one. I mean, there's a few lines that are very key to everything, but this one doesn't have the, you know, the clever line before you shoot the gun, or, you know, or use the knife in Rambo's thing. Yeah.
And the person who has the catchphrases really is Troutman. Because right. Richard Crenna's got some great lines that are very quotable, oh, yeah. Like, you know, a supply of body bags. That one, that's a good line.
You know, we're just a small hick town sheriff's department, Colonel, but we're expected to do our duty just like our heroes in the special forces.
In special forces, we teach our people to stay alive in the line of duty.
No shit, I never thought of that.
You want a war you can't win?
Are you telling me that 200 men against your boy is a no-win situation for us?
You send that many, don't forget one thing.
What?
A good supply of body bags.
To go back to the original book again versus First Blood, is that in the Stallone film, it almost kind of seems like, I mean, you can understand why he gets pushed and why he does what he does. I mean, we get that. But in the book, it seems like this has happened to him dozens of times. It's like in the first chapter, it's like, this has happened to me over and over and over again, and it's stopping now. This is not going to happen again. I'm going to make a stand right now. And you don't get that in First Blood because you don't hear Stallone's character tell you that.
They don't do in the movie just for sake of time and everything, but that Zachary Oberzahn does in the movie of Flooding with Love for the Kid, his interpretation of Morell's book, is the whole taking Rambo, taking him out to the bridge, dropping him off, and then Rambo coming back across the bridge. I mean, because that does happen in the First Blood, but you don't get it as much because he does it, I think, three times in the book and three times in Oberzahn's film. And in Flooding with Love for the Kid, you do get the line about, I thought you were different, you know, because he has had this happen to him so many times before, and he thinks that Teasel might be a different guy, but no, he's not. And yeah, that is something that we miss in the First Blood movie that we do get in Oberzahn's film, is that this has happened to him several times before.
Well, First Blood, both the film and the book, big influence on our next guest. I mean, introduce Zachary Oberzahn. He's the director and, matter of fact, all things creative. And when it comes to his film, ultra low budget, Flooding with Love for the Kid. You'll hear from him in just a minute when we come back on the Projection Booth.
Hey Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
This is Mo. Nothing so odd about him, you may be thinking, except possibly the way he's looking at your barely legal cheerleader daughter. But he seems to have his life together. He has a job, a scooter, a house in the woods with a crawl space full of dolls' heads and empty beer cans. He's all American, rosy cheek, and proud of his heritage. But Mo, like so many others, is hiding a debilitating affliction. He is unable to stop himself from watching really bad movies. The disease has a long, cumbersome Latin name you couldn't hope to understand, but trust me, it's really serious. Left to his own devices, Mo can consume up to 15 truly horrendous motion pictures in under a day. His addiction reached its low point when his friend Bosch, who was just meant to be visiting for the evening, spent almost 3 days incapacitated under a metric ton of black clamshell VHS cases, surviving off nothing but old stale Buncha Crunch and Junior Mints. Mo barely noticed. There is hope, however, and you can help. For just no money at all, you can download an episode of the Drunk on VHS podcast on iTunes, or go to drunkonvhs.blogspot.com and donate nothing whatsoever but your hard-earned time. $0 is all it costs to subscribe to all the episodes and possibly, who knows, save a child. A disease like this can never hope to be cured, but it can be controlled and carefully managed in small doses, or as scientists like to call them, podcasts. We here at the Second Unit Podcast Network are bringing together people like Mo and giving them a forum in which to safely cope with their addiction. You may think it's rare, but a VHS drunkard could be anywhere. That curious uncle you have who at family gatherings wants to show you his collection of nudie playing cards. The disheveled man in your office with the unsuitably long beard and a cubicle picture of Lorenzo Lamas. Hell, it could even be you. Donate by downloading the Drunk on VHS podcast today and support just one of the members of the Second Unit Podcast Network, fighting to make your internet a safe haven for freaks.
Now get it clear. I don't want a kid who looks like you and doesn't have a job in my town.
There's something wrong with you.
It's fucking crazy. I'm fucking crazy.
I never saw anything like it.
Sean's all he said.
Who you been calling cocksuckers?
Gave up 3 years to enlist in a war that was supposed to help his country, and the only trade he came out with is how to kill. Where was he supposed to get a job that needed experience like that?
Is that what you brought us after? A war hero? A fucking Green Beret?
We forced him into it over there, and now he's bringing it all back home.
What this kid do to you?
This is a court of law.
You're on the side!
You're not coming back, are you?
Everybody's gotta go through this, and everybody's still a virgin when I finish.
When I was, I don't know, 9 or 10, we had free HBO for a weekend at my house where I grew up in a little town in Maine. And that was a very wonderful time because movies suddenly, you know, this was even really before VCRs. And so, you know, movies were being sent into your home. And R-rated movies, in fact. And so I remember seeing late at night, I saw, this is like 83, 84, I'm 9 or 10 years old. I remember I saw First Blood, the Stallone version. And I was very touched by it. I was very moved by it, very excited by it, as many boys were, I guess, at that time. I was very touched by the story and very touched by the character. And shortly thereafter, I saw in the supermarket book section, I saw this novel, First Blood, and it had a picture of Stallone on the front because the novel had been reissued because of the popularity of the movie. So I thought to myself, oh, I love this movie. I should read the book. So I read the book as a 9 or 10 year old and was really entranced by it. Really taken by the story, even much more so than the film, because of course, as usually happens, you lose a lot of detail in the adaptation of a novel to a film. And the book was very different, and I was very surprised by the differences. And this was kind of my introduction to those differences that occur between a novel and a film. So this was a very defining moment in my life. Is kind of the moment like when you discover Santa Claus isn't real. Because I loved this book so much and was so touched by it, and touched by both characters, and that's important too, because the sheriff, of course, in the book is a much more detailed and round character than the way he's handled in the Stallone version. It became my dream at that point, even before I got into the arts, just as a kid, as a 9 or 10 year old, to make a true to the novel adaptation, film adaptation of First Blood, because I was so deeply in love with this book. And I read the book quite a bit. I would, it's just a great read, a very fast read, a very exciting read. I read it more than any other book. I'm fairly well read and have read much of the classics, but I always come back to First Blood as my book of choice. It's really my personal classic, and I'd read it every couple of years, and so I've read it probably a dozen times or more. Eventually, I got interested in the arts as a teenager, got interested in theater. Keep in mind, like a lot of people think that I spent my whole life being obsessed with Rambo or with this book. That's not necessarily true. It was always kind of there in the background for me because I thought it was such a brilliant book. But it's not like I had pictures of Rambo up on my wall or things like that. So what eventually happened was I became an actor and director and a filmmaker, went to school for that in college. And like many actors, artists out of college, moved to New York City to show the world what I had. And of course, I was extremely naive and very quickly learned that the world didn't give a damn. The last thing New York needed was another artist out of college. And I tried for many years to audition for plays, and I made some short films, which I would send off to festivals and things like that, and never had any success whatsoever. Never got cast in anything, never got any of my films shown. And I was trying really hard. What I was trying to do, as most people in New York do, or most people that are trying to make a career in the arts. And I was trying to, I mean, looking back on it now, as original as I thought I was really just following a pattern and following the pattern that people follow in order to try and make it in the arts. Auditioning, trying to impress directors, casting agents, that kind of thing, trying to look pretty in the films that I made and the short films that I made. I was attempting to, with my very limited budgets, attempting to mimic the production values of Hollywood, because I felt like that's how I was going to be taken seriously. But of course, I could never quite match that. I was making short films for maybe $500. And of course, they just didn't have the production values of even the student films that get produced in New York City. So I became increasingly frustrated and despondent about all that. And eventually, just realized no one needed me. No one needed me or wanted me. I felt like I was a very talented, hardworking, dedicated artist who had trained for years and had become highly skilled at what I did, but no one had any use for me. And I took that very personally. And I decided eventually that I would just create work for myself. I got so sick of of trying to please the people I was trying to impress, most of whom I didn't respect or respect their work anyway. So I began thinking, like, what do I, you know, well, I love this story, First Blood, and I saw these parallels in a way between myself and Rambo. Here you had Rambo, who was a highly skilled, trained, intelligent individual who came back to America after the war, but the world society had no use for him, despite his talents. And I could associate with that. I could very much sympathize with that. And so I decided, well, you know, I've always wanted to make a film adaptation of First Blood, true to the novel, because the story is so poignant for me and exciting. And I decided, what do I really need? Like, why am I waiting for permission to make it? Like, why am I waiting for Steven Spielberg to call me up? Why am I waiting for someone to give me $50,000 or more to make a film? Why am I waiting for someone to cast me? Why am I waiting for someone to say, okay, Zach, you can play Rambo, or okay, Zach, you can play Wilford Teasel? Like, why was I waiting for that? So I decided I would just do it myself with what I had, realizing too that in every film there is a level of falsity, there's a level of contrivance. It's just a matter of to what degree you want to take it to. To me, watching a film as realistic or naturalistic as they are is still very much a contrivance. When I see a film, I see what's outside the edges of the frame of what the director doesn't want you to see. I see the catering sets and the lights and the makeup people. And that's not to say that a film, by recognizing the falsity of a film, because it is inherently false, but that's not to say, of course, that it still can't be very moving or touching. So I decided along those principles, then I would simply make the film with what I had. And this isn't the woods in Kentucky. This is my 200 square foot apartment in Manhattan. But that didn't matter. I mean, in the original First Blood, it was supposed to take in Stallone's version in the Pacific Northwest, but they actually shot it in Canada. But who cares? You don't stop and say, hey, wait a minute, that's not really the Pacific Northwest. This is Canada. Who cares? So who cares? I'll just do the best I can with what I have and allow my passion and love for the story and the characters to carry the film, believing that that is ultimately what is most important about a film, not the budget and the things associated with a budget. So that's what I did. And when I set out to make it, and I started this project in early 2007, I thought it was going to take about a year to make, but I became so obsessed with it and I had so much fun doing it. It's probably the most fun I ever had in my life. It ended up only taking about eight months or so to make. And as I made it, I had, this is another key point, I had no intention really of sharing the film, of showing it to audiences. I wasn't going to send it off to film festivals. I knew that, or I assumed that the world or most of the world wouldn't take this seriously because it looks like, at first look, it looks just like a guy running around in his apartment covered in barbecue sauce. So that was another extremely freeing element for me, whereas all the work I had done up until that point was very highly conscious of, well, how are people going to view this? Is this going to look good enough? Is this perfect enough? Is this going to have enough meaning for an audience? All of those things that I was so worried about beforehand, I completely threw out the window and made this film essentially for myself with my own aesthetics. And surprisingly, or ironically, I guess it's when I fully embraced those limitations and embraced not giving a damn what the world would think, that the world started to take notice.
The book, the story, you know, it makes sense in the context of post-Vietnam, but what do you think it can tell us about today?
The book, which is a wonderful, wonderful book, needless to say, is really, for me, a love story. And it's a love story between fathers and sons and their ability or inability to find common ground. And so the fact that it is about, in large part, Vietnam, or the effect that Vietnam had on people, that in a way is, not to diminish it, but somewhat secondary, because wars come and go. There will always there will always be wars. There are plenty of wars before Vietnam, and there'll be plenty after. So not to diminish the relevance of Vietnam or the people that were involved in it, but it's really a love story, and you could place it anywhere. It's universal in that sense.
Now, it's my understanding that before you did the film, you used to do a one-man show version of this on stage.
That's, in a way, kind of in part also what it grew out of. This was just about the time I was working with a theater company. I had been working with them for about 10 years doing our own work. And this was just about the time when the theater company was starting to get noticed in New York and abroad. And one of the shows that we created was called Rambo Solo. The film is a separate entity, or became a separate entity and project, but in a sense grew out of that, because Rambo Solo was a show in which I spend about an hour and a half on stage talking from memory, relating the story of First Blood as I remember it, and going off on various tangents about my relationship with it and comparing it and contrasting it to Stallone's version. And near the end of that hour and a half monologue, I begin to muse to myself, I've always really wanted to make my own film version of it, but never had the resources or opportunity. And maybe I should just make this film myself and not give a damn, and just use various parts of my apartment to represent the town and the mountains, and I could play all the characters myself, and I've got a video camera. And so what's really stopping me from making this film other than a paradigm that says you have to have certain things to make a film? Then, as we began rehearsing the piece, the theater piece, I started to take that idea very seriously and decided to actually take myself up on that challenge. And so that was the impetus, in a way, for the film. And again, I had no ideas as I was making the films, I started to make it, that it would be of any interest or to anyone. And eventually what we ended up doing was at the end, I completed the film, and then eventually the theater piece opened. And what we would do is at the end of the theater piece, we would show the trailer for the film, and the audience would, most of the audience would laugh, because they didn't think I was serious. They thought I made a 1 minute trailer to play as a joke at the end of the piece. But I would then announce to the audience after the trailer played that no, in fact, I did make this entire film in my apartment. And if you want to, you can buy a DVD, because I wanted people to see it. I didn't make it with the intention of anyone seeing it, but once I got out there on stage and began telling the story and showing the trailer, I thought, yeah, what the hell? I should show this film to people. So I started selling the DVD after the theater performances, and that's really how it got noticed and eventually got picked up, or interest shown in it by some journalists, and eventually got a week-long run at Anthology Film Archives in New York City in January of 2010, which was 3 years after I made it. But that having a week-long run in New York City allowed it to get reviewed, and very surprisingly, it got reviewed quite extensively, and all of the reviews were quite enthusiastic. And since that time, film festivals, venues, film centers, art centers all over the world have contacted me and continue to contact me to show the film. I don't submit it at all. I gave up on submitting my work trying to get people to show my work. I'm much more content now with having people come to me and ask to view my work.
I love the way that you adapted the story. What were some of your decisions around what you're going to keep and what you're going to get rid of? And really, how did you do some of the actual shooting? I mean, how did you put it together, and what was that whole process like? I know that's kind of a two-pronged question.
Most of the actual physical filming, of course, is relatively simple, because, of course, I was alone in my apartment. I had three rules that I set for myself at the beginning of the project, and one of them was that, just as Rambo, I mean, it was a metaphor. What I was doing to me was a metaphor for Rambo himself and his struggle. And so, just as Rambo had had nothing when he escaped from the police station and ran out into the woods and had to wage this war fully on his own by his own wits with whatever resources were at hand. I took that very much to heart and just applied that to the film. So everything had to be done by me. So of course that meant mostly just, that's why most of the shots are just still shots, because it involved just me setting up the camera on a tripod and running in front of it and acting and then running back and checking to see how it looked. I embraced that simplicity of it. I embraced that amateurishness of it. You'll notice in the some of the opening shots, characters' heads get half cut off or things like that. That wasn't an artistic decision. It was because I hadn't yet perfected my technique of knowing where to stand in front of the camera. But it was things like that I embraced rather than say, oh, well, this is shit. I can't use this shot. I cut off half my head. Instead, I said, well, that's the way it's meant to be. In this shot, you're meant to only see half my head. In terms of what I kept or what I didn't keep from the book, another one of the three rules was that I wanted to, as an experiment, see if I could adapt it as closely as possible, as literally as possible. Meaning, for example, every line of dialogue that's in the book will be spoken and nothing more. Of course, you know, usually when books get adapted into a film, one of the first things you lose is a lot of the dialogue, because directors, screenwriters want to keep the action moving, want to keep the pace going. And you can get bogged down in dialogue pretty quickly in a film, whereas in a book, you can go on for pages with dialogue. Some people who see the film say, gee, you know, this would be a really great film if you just like cut 20 minutes of like that conversation between Teasel and Troutman. But it was my intention, it was my experiment to see if I could in fact keep all of that, film it, make it cinema, and see if it worked. To me, it works. I don't get bored by it. That being said, I admit I did cheat a few times. There are a few lines of dialogue I think I eventually did cut, and maybe one or two sentences that I added in order to make a couple scenes flow together. But 98% of the dialogue is exactly the same as the novel, as well as the settings for each scene, and for the most part too, the props and costumes are as close as I could approximate with what was in my apartment.
It takes a few minutes, I think, when someone sees it who's not used to what the idea is off the top. Who's used to watching a traditional Hollywood film, sure. Is, as I explained it to someone, is you don't have special effects, you have symbolic effects, that these things like the branches or the bear or the bathtub or the sink, things like that are all stand-ins for things. So mm-hmm. How did you kind of come up with ideas of, okay, well, if this scene is supposed to be by the river, then I'm going to shoot this by the sink with the water on. Like, how did you kind of, you know, think your way through how you could take literally, like you said, 220 odd square feet and turn it into a huge idea?
That was one of the most fun parts of it, because this was real in a sense, I guess what you would call guerrilla filmmaking, in that because I was unconcerned with all of the production values that normally go along with a traditional film, I didn't have to spend hours setting up lighting and sound equipment and reflectors and things like that. I could just say, hey, wouldn't this scene look great over here? Set up my camera and shoot. So I didn't do any storyboarding. I did very little pre-planning. I was working a day job at the time at an office. And so I shot most of this at night. During my day at the office, I would study my lines and then go home that night and shoot the scenes that I had learned the lines for. And I would just look around my apartment and say, okay, now I've got to shoot. Here's a gas station scene. Rambo is leaning up against a gas pump. I don't have a gas pump, but I've got a refrigerator that kind of looks like a gas pump. It's kind of the size of a gas pump. I'll lean up against the refrigerator. Rambo's standing near a running stream. Well, what do I have around here that could kind of be like a running stream? Well, I'll turn the faucet on and stand next to it. Rambo lies in a riverbed and covers himself with mud. well, I don't have a riverbed and I can't really flood my apartment. I'll get in trouble. That was the other thing. I couldn't, you know, I didn't want to get in trouble for destroying parts of my apartment. So I just, well, the bathtub is, I'll just turn the shower on and get in the bathtub. So it was really just kind of obvious things, you know, and I have like a loft bed that's about 10 feet high. And so, of course, when it came to the scene of Rambo's trying to climb down the cliff and a helicopter shooting at him, well, I'll hang from my loft bed. My loft bed is kind of like a cliff. I can hang from my loft bed and jump off of it. So a lot of it was just spur of the moment.
When it came to shooting the individual characters, how did you do the scenes? Did you do like all one character first and then go back and do the other? Were you doing both sets of lines so that you could make sure that you had the tone right? Because obviously you're not playing off someone, you're playing off yourself.
I would shoot one character at a time, shoot that entire character, and then go back to the beginning of the script and become a different character, and then go through the whole script and shoot that character. A lot of this having to do with, I realized at the beginning of the project, I needed various ways of distinguishing myself, as many ways as possible to distinguish myself, since I'm playing all the characters, so that you can tell, you know, who's who. One of the ways I did that was with my hair and facial hair. Rambo in the book looks like a real hippie. He's got long hair and a beard, and so I grew long hair and a beard in order to play Rambo, and started with him first, and so shot all the scenes with Rambo. Then went back to the beginning, got a haircut, left some of the facial hair, left a mustache, and did all of Orville's scenes because I decided Orville should have a mustache, and then trimmed the mustache and got another haircut and did some of the deputies. And then got another haircut and did Teasel. So I went about it that way. And so a lot of it was kind of like a chess game in remembering when and how the last, because you're delivering lines to yourself, but not only to yourself 3 months ago. So a lot of it was remembering. How, like, okay, when I shot Teasel, he moved here, then here, then here during this bit of dialogue. So now 2 months later, I'm playing Troutman and I'm responding to that dialogue. I've got to move here and here and here and react this way because I delivered that line as Teasel this way. And for the most part, I think I did a pretty good job at that. There's a few places where maybe only I could notice them, but there's a few places where I notice where, because of the lapse of time in between a character's response, is a little askew to the way to the prompting line, and that's because months had passed in between. But I think that just adds to the charm.
Just a real geek question: how did you do the, you know, two actors or multiple actors on screen at the same time?
I realized that I would need to or wanted to be able to have, since it was just myself, have more than one of me on screen at a time, so that the entire film, because I thought it would get a bit tedious if all of the film was just cutting back and forth from one character to the next. I felt like it had to, at some points, at least have some, be able to see two or more characters at once on screen interacting, particularly for fight scenes. Like what most of the project was experimentation. I was familiar with Final Cut Pro, the basics of it anyway, from having made a few short films before. And I knew that there was some way that in movies they do that blue screen business where they, you know, shoot something against a blue screen, then take out the blue screen and overlay the shots, and so that you can have... And that was literally the extent of my knowledge of doing such special effects, just the vague notion of blue screen. So I have this white wall in my little kitchen, and I decided, oh, well, that'll be a good, I don't have a blue screen, but I got this white wall, and maybe I can use that as a kind of blue screen. So I did some experiments with that at the beginning of the process to see if I could in fact figure out a way to put two or more of myself in the scene at once. And I played around with a lot of different effects on Final Cut Pro to figure out how to do that. I tried different masking things and cropping things and key color things and chroma things and all sorts of things that I actually don't understand because I never read the manual for Final Cut Pro and I don't have a real filmmaking background. So it was all experimentation. Eventually, I hit upon this combination that allowed me to overlay, although it, of course, the effect isn't perfect, kind of the characters, parts of them get kind of shaky or get kind of ghostly looking. But again, that didn't concern me. So long as I could see both characters or more characters at once on screen, even though obviously didn't look photorealistic, that again was part of the charm for me. It was also then at that point I realized I could put in just still backgrounds to help, because I was very concerned about being able to define where the scene was taking place, and I used sound effects a great deal for that, and that became very instrumental. I think what makes the film for a large part is the sound effects, and the sound effects also helped very much set the location. But I also discovered that I could put in with my poor blue screen effect, or rather white screen effect, I would say, oh, okay, this takes place in the town. So I would print again, not leaving my apartment, because nothing could come from outside the apartment. I would just print out stock footage of mountains or a town or what have you, and then just print that out on my printer and then film that and paste that in as the background. And of course, it looks like, well, you know, you've seen it, but again, as you said, it's symbolic effects rather than special effects.
As for the budget, I think you're the only film I've ever seen that credits their budget at the end of the film. And I was wondering what the $95.51 that you spent on the film actually paid for.
It wasn't that I said, all right, like $100 is my limit. I'm not going to go over $100. I didn't set any monetary constraints. I just wanted to do it as simply and cheaply as possible. And it's not even that like I couldn't afford to. I'm not dirt poor. I could have put a lot more money into it, but that wasn't the point. The point was to do it with what I had. That being said, I did cheat a little bit on that. Although most of the budget, about $60, went to tapes. I of course had to buy mini DV tapes, and I shot 12 mini DV tapes. I buy those for $5 a pop, so there was $60 there. That was 2/3 of the budget. I do admit that I brought in a couple of props. One thing that I felt was very important, very symbolic, was the Green Beret itself, as Rambo was a Green Beret. And I wanted to see Troutman wearing an actual Green Beret. I didn't want something representational for that. And I wanted a Green Beret anyway, and so I wear it just for fun now. So I admit that I did buy the Green Beret from eBay for $10. And other than that, then the guns. For some reason, I wanted real guns or realistic looking guns. The guns I used were BB guns. And perhaps if I were a better director or was even braver still, I would have used just finger guns or what have you. But for some reason, I wanted to see guns, real guns, in the context of the apartment. And so I admit that I also bought very cheaply, for like a few dollars, bought these BB guns from eBay. And so that's where I cheated.
So you mentioned you had three rules, and I think I distinctly remember you saying at least two of them, but what was the third rule?
First rule was that everything comes strictly from the novel, nothing more, nothing less. Two, that everything had to come from inside my apartment. And those are the two rules which I admit I did break slightly. But the third and most important rule, which I never broke, was that I had to do everything myself. You can see that best perhaps in no one ever, despite all of the violence and all of the fighting, no one's back ever gets injured very badly because I couldn't reach to put scars on my back. Like the scars on Rambo's chest, I think we're quite well done. I did those myself with some cotton and latex. The ones on the front were quite well done, I think, because of course I could see what I was doing. But the scars on Rambo's back were rather poor in comparison, and that's just because I couldn't reach. And it would have been very easy to, of course, have a friend, have, you know, at any point in this, it would have been very easy to say, to have a friend or to have a neighbor, to have someone just do something very simple like that. Like just, hey, could you put these scars on my back? Or, hey, could you hold the camera for this? Or, you know, hey, could you just do this? But it was very important to me to do it entirely, to see what kind of effect I could get, to see what kind of film I could make simply by myself.
When you started screening it, I think you talked a little bit, at least about the trailer, when you used to show it with pair it with the performance piece.
Yeah.
How did you see the reactions? I mean, did they kind of change over time, or did people seem to get into it when you showed it to them?
For the most part, the audience reaction then to the trailer was, because it's just a minute-long, two-minute-long trailer, for the most part, when people see that, a few people took it seriously, but of course, most people laughed, and I admit there is an element of, I take the work very seriously, but on the other hand too, I admit there is something inherently silly about a grown man cutting off a teddy bear head. But for that matter, films in general, then when you look at them, you know, that are silly. There's something inherently silly about Brad Pitt pretending to shoot someone with a machine gun. So the reaction to the trailer was always kind of, since people were just kind of shocked and surprised by it, with, you know, their initial reaction was always one of sort of humor and disbelief. The interesting thing is at actual screenings of the film where the whole thing plays, the fact that audiences initially for the first 5 or 10 minutes react much the same way as they do when they just see the trailer, because it's, upon first look, it's kind of shocking and silly looking for what people are used to. But the interesting thing is that then as the film goes on, the way that people become drawn into it and begin to accept the world that I created, and that by the end of it take it very seriously, which I think is great.
Is there one particular moment where every audience seems to finally get it, or does it kind of hit people at different times as you've watched them?
Watching a film is so subjective. Everyone's really got different views about what makes a good film, what makes good acting, things like that. And so it really hits people at different times. And it depends largely, you know, on how generous an audience member is. And if that audience member is generous and willing to go along, then I think they are rewarded for it. But still, I mean, a lot of people walk out too. You know, there are people that watch 20 minutes of it and say, this is shit, and walk out, you know, and I don't have much use for those people. So, And other people at various times, where they're with it right from the beginning, or they don't get into it really until, I don't know, the faster action sequences or where it becomes very emotional. So it varies quite a bit.
I was going to ask about reactions that you've had from David Morrell, the writer, and then also Sylvester Stallone, who originally played the Rambo character in First Blood, the original version. Have you heard from them, and what do they think of it?
When I was making the film and working on the theater piece, I had a deep desire to contact David Morrell and tell him that I was doing this because I love the book so much, and I love this piece of art that he created, and I wanted him to know about it. Both because I wanted to say thank you, and also because I thought he perhaps would be interested in it, but I was warned by several people not to contact him, because, you know, there's a lot of problems with copyrights, and I of course didn't have permission for like a theater piece or a film to use this material, and there's been a lot of examples, particularly recently in New York, where theater companies or artists created these great works, but then are unable to show them because of copyright issues. I gave up on that idea. However, I then was one day checking David Morrell's website, and he wrote on his website, "Hey, I just heard that there's this off-Broadway play called Rambo Solo. Isn't that cool?" So I thought, hey, well, he must be a nice, kind of generous guy. He'll probably, you know, will respond well. So I took a chance and I contacted him and said, yeah, I made this theater piece about your book, and I made this film adaptation of your book. He wrote back immediately, and he was thrilled. He's a very, very nice man, very generous. And I sent him a copy of the film. He loved it. He lives in out west, but he came to New York City for a writer's conference a couple summers ago. And so we met and talked, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful speaking with him. He's very proud of my work, and I'm very thankful to him. And we keep in touch. I let him know what the status of the film and where it's playing, and he thinks it's great. Stallone, I've never attempted to contact. I have a feeling that he would not be as generous. And something that David told me was that while David is very supportive of it and promotes it, actually promotes the film itself on his website, he has told me that if and when any lawyers come along and want to shut me down, there's nothing he can do because he sold the film rights to the novel back in the 70s. And so it's kind of out of his hands. So somewhere, he's not even sure where, but it's at some film studio at this point owns the film rights to the novel First Blood. And I guess technically, or maybe Stallone himself does, or his production company. I'm not sure. But I have a feeling that I don't know. I have a feeling that Stallone wouldn't be as generous. Or maybe he would, or maybe he would see that it would be in his favor to be magnanimous and to embrace it. I personally, if it didn't mean getting shut down, I would love for Stallone to see the film, because as much as I wanted to make my own version of the book, because I thought the Stallone version didn't do it justice, I don't judge it so much anymore. I mean, that's its own version. There's different versions of a story can be told in different ways, and there's really no one best way to tell a story. And what Stallone did with it was what Stallone did with it. And First Blood as a movie, the Ted Ketchoff version is very good. In its way, if it weren't for that film, none of this would have ever happened. And I think Stallone is a great actor, and in an ideal world, I would love for Stallone to see it and give me a cameo in Rambo 5, but I don't know if that'll happen.
The audience reaction, I mean, you've seen, like you said, I know the Village Voice gave you a good review. There was, I think, maybe a New York Times review that was really good. Were you sort of surprised that people got it?
Yeah, my faith in humanity was redeemed a bit. I thought no one would get it, and so I'm pleasantly surprised and shocked that many people do get it, and not just avant-garde artists that would be willing to embrace something very, very weird or non-traditional. You know, your average moviegoer, not all, of course, many of them still just can't get over the, just can't take it seriously, but surprisingly, a large number of people and all of the critics that have written about it and many audience members, even being people that aren't avant-garde film enthusiasts or whatever, like it and enjoy it. And that's very special for me. I mean, I'm glad that I made a piece that could speak to people. And I think the reason it does that is that it's very honest and it's very passionate. And I think, surprisingly, and I'm surprised by this, but the average person, the average moviegoer, the average, actually, you know, there's some people, of course, that are always going to dismiss it, but the average film goer, I think ultimately will appreciate seeing passion on screen and will forgive, so to speak, the lack of production value.
What have you done since then? I know there's been a long time since this has passed. So what have you done since? And then what's coming up for you next?
My follow-up project to that is called Your Brother, Remember. And it started out as a film follow-up to Flooding with Love for the Kid, but then became, it's had a sort of strange history, because then became a a film/theater piece, and now is becoming a standalone film again. And what it involves is myself, my brother, and Jean-Claude Van Damme, in a way making this sort of home movie version as an adult in my apartment was not completely unprecedented, because when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I used to, for fun, I'd borrow the video camera from the school library, and my brother and I would make films at home, kind of parodies of films that we thought were really funny. And we, of course, just made them for ourselves and had a good time doing that, and did them very, very simply. Just shot them in our living room with household items as props. And so a couple of the movies that we happened to do were Kickboxer, Jean-Claude Van Damme's Kickboxer, and Faces of Death. So this was 20 years ago. And then, so I was trying to think of a follow-up project to Flooding with Love for the Kid. And in my mind, I had made a film that was just as, I had made a Hollywood film. I made a film that was just as worthy, that was just as good, if not better, than any film Hollywood produced. So I said to myself, oh, well, I should continue in the steps of Hollywood. And what does Hollywood do? Hollywood remakes its own films every 20 years or so. But Hollywood, when it remakes its films, it updates the film to the latest actors and hairstyles and music and clothes and body fat ratios and things like that. But what I was interested in doing was remaking my old films, but trying to keep as many of the variables the same as possible, so that you would see the difference of 20 years in the bodies and the voices, in the locations and the costumes. And so I went back to my childhood home, where my brother still lived, and reshot scene for scene all of these home movies we made 20 years ago, primarily Kickboxer and Faces of Death. So that became my new project. And then I interweave the three different films, the originals we made 20 years ago, the remakes that I just made, and the actual film, actual shots from Kickboxer and Faces of Death. And I interweave those three, and on stage, I go on stage and pretend to be, or tell everyone that I'm Jean-Claude Van Damme, and I sort of narrate them through this look back over the past 20 years, because I found many parallels in the life of myself, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and my brother. The climb to success, the struggle with drugs, a variety of things. And so I made this piece that was, it's kind of a tribute to both my brother and Jean-Claude Van Damme. It's a very poignant piece, although it certainly has its silly moments as well. And so I've been touring this as a theater piece for the past couple of years. It's been doing very well. And I've also made a standalone, since most of it is film, I've made a standalone film version of it, which I'm now starting to show. It's going to have a run in New York. So we'll see where that goes.
Well, you've done stuff with Stallone and Jean-Claude Van Damme. Are there any other 80s action actors whose careers you want to sort of riff off of next?
No, I don't really. I love action films. I love the genre of action films. I love watching all those films. And I find that people like, you know, I do. I'll watch any films and appreciate them for what they are. But I do find that actors like, I do have a special affinity for Stallone and for Jean-Claude Van Damme, because I think that, particularly Jean-Claude Van Damme, because I think he's very sincere. I think he's a wonderful actor. It doesn't matter to me that he's not the kind of actor that Meryl Streep is. I'd much rather see the sincerity of Jean-Claude Van Damme than the craft of Meryl Streep. My interest in film runs the whole gamut, and along with action films, I'm also very fond of Iranian art films. I'm a big fan of Abbas Kiarostami, and my next project, I'm not sure, but my next project may have something to do with that. Might be a riff off of Kiarostami.
That ends part three of our four-part series, Flooding with Love for First Blood, Son. Be sure to come back next week as we conclude the series.